actually happened, but it wasn't by some grand decree. It's like trying to explain why nobody saw it once everyone started to see that the world was much smaller than ever before. And over there wasn't so far anymore. What we did unto others washed up on our shore. The answer was hard to ignore. The end of war. The end of war.
Welcome to Peace Talk. I'm Rich Moniak, your host for tonight's program. Peace Talk is a production of KTOO's Focusing Community, and it's sponsored by the Juneau Chapter of Veterans for Peace. It is VFP's contribution to the ongoing conversation our community has about the issues of war and peace, how it affects the world, and our society here at home. Tonight's program, we will be talking about the origins of Veterans for Peace as an organization, as well as some of its members, its primary members here in Juneau and nationally. Most people aren't aware that Veterans for Peace is not an organization that began during the Vietnam War, nor during the Iraq War that started 8 years ago. It's an organization that's 25 years old, or 26 now, started in 1985. With me in the studio tonight, we'll be talking with John Dunker, who was instrumental in establishing the Juneau chapter of Veterans for Peace in 2003, I believe. Welcome to the show, John.
Thanks, Rich.
And speaking to us live from Maine over the phone is Doug Rollins. Doug was one of the founders of the original organization in 1985. Welcome, Doug.
Thanks.
So, Doug, why don't we start with what you can kind of give us an idea of what was going on in 1985 that led a group of veterans to get together to start this organization?
Well, it was Ronald Reagan's policies in Central America that really jump-started us. Nicaragua, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador. We're supporting a lot of wars down there. And I was in a church in Farmington, Maine, and a few folks came by to talk about the Witness for Peace program, I believe it was. They'd just come back from Nicaragua. And one of the speakers, Jerry Genacio, said, you know, I'm looking for some veterans who want to think about forming a peace group. So that was, I believe, 1984, I think. And then it started from there, and there were six of us finally got together and hashed out a goals and mission statement and whatnot. And off we went. One of our first actions was five of our members went on a water-only fast and sat on the Capitol, steps of the Capitol in Washington, D.C., in protest the wars in Nicaragua. And one of our members, by the way, early members, is Charlie Litke, who has a distinction of being the only person who's won the Congressional Medal of Honor and then turned it in. And he did that in protest of our wars in Central America as a member of Veterans for Peace.
So were you all veterans that served in Vietnam?
No. Two of us served in Vietnam. Jerry Genacio was a Marine who served peacetime. And we had a World War II veteran as well.
And the others?
Were Vietnam-era veterans. But
didn't see any combat.
But only two of us served in Vietnam, right. Yeah.
So and how did the organization grow nationally? I mean, it sounds like you started out in one local place.
Well,
took a national agenda, obviously. You were interested in what was going on in Central America. You went to the Capitol. How long did it take to grow and to become more than just the six of you?
I think we had, within a year, I think we had 32 different chapters around the states. And this is, of course, this might shock some of your listeners, but this was before the Internet actually existed. And literally, we sat behind typewriters and typed out letters to editors and sent out little announcements to newspapers and just started putting the word out. And we had apparently struck a chord with a fair amount of veterans who jumped on board right away.
So did the organization stay pretty much that size until 2003? No.
It actually grew fairly rapidly at first and then plateaued out. You know, I can't think of the exact numbers, but it started with a, you know, one chapter in Maine, and then we had five chapters, and then six chapters, and then we had 30 chapters, and it started spreading further and further out. So we probably ended up with about 5,000 members within about 10 years.
And how does that compare with today?
We're holding steady at about 4,000 now, I think. We peaked at 7,000 last, the number I heard. You know, again, this is, you know, we're trying to put together these numbers, but that's pretty, I think, fairly accurate. When the Iraq wars began, our membership spiked.
Yeah, and then, of course, the Iraq wars got a new organization, the Iraq Veterans
Correct.
Against the War.
Yeah, actually, they formed at our Boston convention. We were,
right.
we were their mentors. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought I'd jump in and just observe that although our chapter didn't start till 2003, we sort of have roots back in 85 and around that time, since we a lot of us were active in our foreign adventures in Central America, and a lot of our civilian friends would occasionally urge us to form a veterans peace organization. Many of us were active in Juno People for Peace and Justice back in the mid-80s, and they continued to urge us to form a chapter, which we eventually did, as Rich said, in 03. April of 03 is when we sent in our petition for chapter status.
Well, Doug, I'm not a veteran. I've never served in the armed services, let alone been to combat. You and John have both served in Vietnam. My curiosity is you know, where does the passion come from both veterans who have served in combat as well as the others who haven't, but particularly, you know, what keeps you going for at, you know, 25, 26 years at this?
Well, speaking personally, but I think I'm fairly representative. We have children. I have a son and a daughter, two children, and now I have grandchildren. And I look at their world, and I think it would be unconscionable for me not to do something to try to bring this world to peace, just to benefit my own kids. So that's been a driving force for me. And I've worked professionally now over the last 25, 26 years and raised a family, so I've been in and out of the organization. I haven't been a committed member for, 7 days a week, rather, for 24 hours, quite a while. But I've come back on board in the last few years and still at it. So I think the passion comes from that. And having witnessed war firsthand, I think we do have an obligation to speak to younger generations. I've taught at a college now for 26 years and try to speak to that generation as much as I possibly can.
And how much do you talk about your war experience in detail or you know?
Well, it varies. I'm teaching a course in peace studies now, as a matter of fact, and using a wonderful book, History of Nonviolence in America, and Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. And discussions go back and forth, and eventually we get to the Vietnam War, and students are oftentimes a bit stunned by the fact that in passing, if it's part of the course, I'll mention that I served in Vietnam. But and I go speak in different high school settings and stuff. I just came back from speaking to a group of students who were reading Tim O'Brien's Things They Carried. And just try to talk about that stuff.
Yeah, that's a splendid book. I read that a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it's the best, I think, personal opinion.
Yeah, I know, John, you served as a helicopter pilot, I believe, right?
Right.
And,
yes.
You know, you mentioned you were involved with different peace groups, but in 2003, something, obviously the Iraq War led to the establishment of VFP here in Juneau.
Yeah, I, like a lot of Vietnam veterans who had a critical view of that war, were members of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. I was not active in that organization. I don't know if I even paid my dues every year, but I've always felt an affection for it, try to stay up with them. And that's, in a way, at least for me, one of the progenitors of Veterans for Peace. Their focus and the fact that their name signals their focus on Vietnam, at least at the time, I thought made Veterans for Peace a great organization to explore, which I and several other folks in the Juneau area, several other veterans, had explored and joined earlier than we formed the chapter. We were just at large members. Some of us didn't even know that we were members, you know, and we'd discover this gradually. But that experience and the fact that every time I'd get a newsletter from Veterans for Peace National Office and or any kind of news from another chapter, it just would buoy me, make me feel like I wasn't alone in the desert. By 2003, for that and other reasons, I thought, gee, it's time to try to pay something back for that, you know, and support it in a more organized way.
Well, I'd like to ask both of you, if there's one unique moment you experienced in the transition from soldier to civilian to activist, the thing that puts you over the top that finally said, where you finally said, you know, I've got to do something. I've got to stand up. I've got to take a position that's visible. My war experience is valuable for that. Whatever it is, is there one memorable moment where things just changed for you and silence was no longer an option?
Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay, I'll jump in there. It may take a little while because it took me a little while. It took me a long while. I don't have any one epiphany. I have a whole bunch of little ones where I resolve, damn it, I'm going to do something. I want to try to let people know that there are other viewpoints about the war than the official propaganda or the mainstream media. I want to do it more forcefully. I intuitively knew this would take group action and not just something from me. But I didn't have my stuff together enough to actually move on in those various little moments that maybe at the time it felt like an epiphany, but it didn't get my butt in action, you know. So I guess I'm a late bloomer that way. It took me quite a while to have the self-confidence and the help of friends and my wife and community to get with other folks in a similar situation and try to put together our chapter. And I'm very proud of that. But not one big epiphany, I'm afraid. Just a bunch of small outrages that I witnessed in Vietnam, instances of how the government had lied to us, of how the people did not want us there, about the utter horror and utter waste, and then subsequently the way veterans were sometimes treated or disregarded, or assumptions made about where their heads were at and that sort of thing. They all just kind of stacked up over time.
And yeah, I'm glad you said it like that, because I was searching for an epiphany, and there wasn't one for myself either. I got out of Nam in 70 and drifted up to Boston. I had already graduated from college, and I got a job in a Coast Guard hospital and just counting out pills and just trying to get my head back together again. And I joined the Socialist Workers' Party, you know, and VVAW, skirted around the edges of VVAW in Boston and stuff, and went down to demonstrations in D.C. But I was incredibly angry, but I had no way to channel that anger. And it took years, right? I mean, 85, 15 years later, after trying to start a couple of other small groups, we just hit on it, right, with this notion of nonviolence as a strategy, you know, and abolition of war as our major goals, as visionary, as some people would call that. And that just gave it to me. That gave me the focus, the long-term vision. And then, as you mentioned, using our military experience as a positive factor. Some would claim that we do this work out of penance, perhaps, but maybe that's involved to some degree. But, you know, I just think that again, as I mentioned before, it's an obligation we have to younger people to at least tell them the truth about war and cut through some of the crap that they're exposed to. So it wasn't an epiphany for me either. It was a series of rising anger and then sort of disillusionment and then having children, as I mentioned before. That was really the precipitating stuff for me when my kids were 2 and 3 and 4 years old. I would look into their eyes, you know, and you know what it's like to look into the eyes of the Vietnamese children and realize I've got to do something. So that's where it started.
So you were pretty much alone when you began VFP. I mean, with 6 people, you grew quite a bit. Did the other people that you've known that have started to step out, you know, since you have, if they all express the same type of thing, a slow emergence of this need to speak out?
Yeah, for people of my generation, yeah, I do think so, right? You know, it takes a while to resist the, you know, the groupthink. Jane Addams wrote a wonderful essay about that during World War I, how difficult it was for conscience objectors and people during World War I to sort of break the mold, and how hard it is to get out of that lockstep way of thinking. And also there was, you know, I think a lot of non-vets were turned their anger, you know, inside, and they were, you know, confused and whatnot. And I think we gave them a chance to take their anger, which I think is a valuable resource, by the way. I don't think there's anything wrong with anger. We were able to get their anger outside of themselves and putting it to some positive work. And that's appealed to a lot of people. And I would mention, by the way, that we even had Spanish Civil War veterans in our organization. So we had a range from the Spanish Civil War, World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, since then.
Well, I think the epiphany idea, you know, it strikes a lot of people. You know, there's a lot of famous people that you can read about. I mean, Daniel Ellsberg's book is one that fascinates me. You know, turning the Pentagon Papers over after being inside the government for many years. He served in the Marines, I believe, in the 50s.
He was in Nam, but he was an
advisor to the State Department then.
Right.
And it's still, if you read his book, his epiphany came across very, very slow. And it would seem that the slower, the more, it almost brings on a more mature outward growth to where it'll last. Whereas if something happens quickly, you could lose it just as quickly. But if it's something that matures slowly, it sinks in, it becomes deep, and it's rooted in you forever.
We should point out, of course, Ellsberg belongs to Veterans for Peace, as does Howard Zinn, as did Howard Zinn.
Yeah, and Anne Wright's another one that I've become very familiar with, you know, who I don't, you know, we all know her story that she resigned the night of the, before the invasion of Iraq, but how much of what was going on led her to realize it was time to do something. And I know personally she didn't expect to be doing nearly as much as she is right now when she first resigned. So, again, it's that there seems to be a slow progression towards having a larger voice.
Right. And you mentioned community, John. I think that's incredibly important, too. That's what we find amongst ourselves. You know, Maine, like Alaska, is a sparsely populated state. It's a huge state. And to get people together, we have about 120 members in our chapter. And to get people together on a monthly basis or to do actions and stuff like that takes a lot of work and commitment on people's part. You know, we drive 3 or 4 hours to do a demonstration or something like that, or you go into a school. That's some commitment.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. We, as you say, we're sparsely populated, but that's when you imagine our population evenly spread over the landscape, which it definitely is not. If you include small villages in the term urban, we are a highly urbanized population, but many of those villages and towns are difficult to get from one to the other. Here in Southeast Alaska, even where we have a ferry system and pretty good aviation, it takes an investment just to communicate. We're getting better wireless and all that, so maybe things are improving in that regard, but right now, I've communicated with veterans in other Southeast Alaska towns who You know, I've told them, hey, they have to get 10 of their anti-war veteran friends to sign up and form a chapter. I was glad to receive word from our national office about a week ago that that's no longer correct. If you're an isolated village or something, I guess there are circumstances where they'll accept a petition for chapter status from only 5 veteran members. So that might ease the burden for some of them, but so far we're the only chapter in Southeast Alaska. There is a chapter in Fairbanks and a chapter in Anchorage. It would be great to see more because it's pretty hard for us to visit one another and work on things together.
Well, as peace organizations go, you know, my sense in Juneau and in other places I've been is that VFP brings a lot more credibility to the argument. And I think, you know, VFP here in Juneau usually puts a float together for the parade. It's usually pretty creative. There's not as many veterans that walk in it as there are people that are behind it with the Juneau People for Peace and Justice, but the veterans always lead it, and they get recognized immediately as bringing something extra to the debate. There's a much greater deal of respect that and appreciation for veterans for both their service as well as for the service that I consider that they're given now in speaking out. I think it's an invaluable service that, as you said, Doug, you know, you've seen the war. Most of us haven't. There is a responsibility that it's great that some people feel that they have to bring it home that way.
Yeah, and you know, oftentimes we're characterized as an anti-military organization, and we're really not. I mean, for example, we've given up the notion of taking out what we call counter-recruitment. We call it full disclosure. You know, we're willing to sit down and talk to young people about what military service really involves. And I like to point out the contract that I call it a sacred contract that somebody who goes into the service makes with the government, and that's, you know, we're willing to sacrifice our time, our energy, even our lives, if you will, to protect the Constitution of the United States and the American people. And the other signee under that contract, the government, says we won't ask you to give those sacrifices unless it is for those two purposes. And when the government, you know, faults on that end of the agreement, then all bets are off. And that's the discussion I like to have with students. You know, and, I consider myself a nonviolent direct activist now, and opposed to all war. So I like to talk to students about that. But I do think there's something noble and grand in service to one's community, and sometimes that takes the form of military service. End of speech. Sorry.
Doug, John here. I was wondering if you'd like to talk a little bit about the way Veterans for Peace hashes over difficult issues amongst our members. We observed in Juneau here some criticism of our group for not condemning the Afghanistan war more effectively, and you know, we've been suspected as simply being Bush haters, sort of thing. And the organization has, I think, proved that that's not the case. But we are more principled. but maybe you'd like to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, and Doug, before you answer that, I've got one specific question that our chapter president sent me from Mexico. He actually sent me a text message to get this to you. And as a member of the board now, right, Doug?
Yes, right.
Yeah, you weren't there at the convention, though, I don't believe.
Not in Portland, no. Not in Oregon.
But the national organization voted on a resolution calling for the impeachment of President Obama.
Yeah.
And it's come up 3 times. In the past 3 conventions. It passed this time. It was the most heated debate that went on before that. Phil asked me to get your thoughts on what that might do to other coalition building that we do, whether that level of politics is is worth the price. We've got at least one member in our chapter who has stopped paying, one active member who has decided to stop paying national dues.
Is that Phil Restino that asked you that?
No.
Okay, Phil. Yeah, okay, it's very interesting because I've just literally got off the phone about a half an hour ago for my first conference call as a member of the board. January I start the whole thing. And we had a number of discussions, and it just reminded me of the old days. It was the same kind of thing. We discussed way back in the 85, 86 about what we should do about homosexuals and gays in the military and stuff. This is before, you know, don't ask, don't tell kind of stuff. And what I like about our organization is that we listen to all voices, at least that's been my experience, and we try to reach consensus whenever possible. And we openly discuss these things from both a philosophical as well as strategic point of view. So the Obama thing, I have to say, as disappointed as I am in his continuation of the Bush policies and his surge of troops into Afghanistan, all those things that really bother me, I don't think calling for his impeachment is a good strategic move because it essentially lumps us with, you know, with the organizations that we don't necessarily want to be associated with, people who are attacking Obama, the administration, for other reasons and stuff. So, you know, I think we should condemn what he's done, but not go as far as calling for his impeachment. I think it would just call too much attention to that particular thing and hurt our cause in other ways. So I'm against that. But other issues, you know, come up when we discuss them. We discuss them at the chapter level, and we discuss them at the national level, and we try to come to some kind of resolution, and it's a sloppy, contentious process. I don't know if they shared with you one of the other contentious issues was our infamous banner drop from the News Museum in Washington, D.C., which used some language that some people objected to. And we had actually had people quit the organization because they were offended by that particular action. And again, it was just bad strategy, some people thought. So we did, when we formed the group, you know, we talked about, you know, working to abolish war, et cetera, but we did say in our, we have a little clause in our opening statement that said we serve others for the larger purpose of world peace. And so that's what we had to constantly be going back to. Are we serving, you know, are we staying true to our mission by the actions that we take? Are we, you know, is it advancing the cause for world peace? And if it's not, it's as strong as we might feel about them as individually, we have to say as an organization, we're not going to make that public stance. And resolutions are a very interesting process. It's always been an interesting process in our organization. But I don't think that particular, I don't know, resolution, I guess we call it, was an effective one. I hate to say that.
Well, I think you mentioned abolishing war several times, and I think the national mission statement say to abolish war as an instrument of foreign policy or something to that effect? Is that more what you're referring to? I mean, I think I read your statement when you were running for the board, and you don't have a vision of abolishing war in your lifetime, at least.
No, but I mean, I think we should always have that kind of vision to be working towards, right?
Right.
Go ahead.
That was the opening song. I don't know if you were able to hear much of that. It's just a piece of a song called "The End of War" by Eric Colville, who's, I believe, he's from Boston. It was an award-winning song in 2009, and he gave us permission to use it. But it's an interesting thing to read. His how he came up with that. It's supposed to be about he's talking to his grandson, like you're saying. You talk to your children and referring back to war that people today don't understand because it was over a long time ago. So it's kind of a dream for the abolition of war. But with that, I think we'll take a break. Doug, I've got a song of yours that you requested, Sam Stone.
Oh, yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, and we'll play that. Who was the who's the songwriter?
John Prine.
John Prine. Okay, I left my notes at John's house before we get over here, so I don't have anything in front of me.
Okay.
All right, we'll be listening to Sam Stone by John Prine.
Sam Stone came home to his wife and family after serving in the conflict overseas. And time that he served had shattered all his nerves and left a little shrapnel in his knee. But the morphine eased the pain, and the grass grew around his brain and gave him all the confidence he lacked. With a purple heart and a monkey on his back, there's a hole in Daddy's arm where all the money goes. Jesus Christ died for nothing, I suppose. Little pitchers have big ears, don't stop to count the years. Sweet songs never last too long on broken radios. Sam Stone's welcome home didn't last too long. He went to work when he'd spent his last dime. And Sammy took to stealing when he got that empty feeling for $100 habit without overtime. And the gold rolled through his veins like a thousand railroad trains. Needs his mind in the hours that he chose, while the kids ran around wearing other people's clothes. There's a hole in Daddy's arm where all the money goes. Jesus Christ died for nothing, I suppose. Little pitchers have big ears, don't stop to count the years. Sweet songs never last too long on broken radios. Sam Stone was alone when he popped his last balloon, climbing walls while sitting in a chair. Well, he played his last request while the room smelled just like death, with an overdose hovering in the air. But life, it lost its fun, there was nothing to be done but trade his house that he bought on the G.I. Bill for a flag-draped casket on a local hero's hill. There's a hole in Daddy's arm where all the money goes. Jesus Christ died for nothing, I suppose. Little pitchers have big ears, don't stop to count the years. Sweet songs never last too long on broken radios.
That was Sam Stone by John Prine, and you're listening to KTOO in Juneau. This is Peace Talk. I'm Rich Moniak, and tonight's show we've got John Dunker from Juneau, Veterans for Peace, and Doug Rollins from the Maine chapter as well as the National Board, talking to us about the history of VFP and their own personal passions for why they're involved with the organization. So, Doug, tell us what that song means to you. I mean, at least I think most songs, when we find them compelling to us for some reason, there's got to be a story behind it. Is there one for you there?
Yeah, I mean, I discovered John Prine in, I think, 71. I think that came out in 71, 72, and I wasn't doing drugs or anything like that, but I was in deep despair, and that song sort of captures for me that lonely realization a soldier gets if he or she is really conscious of what's happening. of all the ghosts and all the horrific parts of the war, and trying to deal with that. And there are so many Vietnam veterans who didn't. It's a well-known statistic that more Vietnam veterans killed themselves than died in combat. And that's just using Department of Defense numbers. You know, to the current day, 18 veterans and active duty service members killing themselves every day now. Another staggering statistic from the DOD. So I think that's the probably... I think what Prine captured was that lonely despair that many soldiers get if they don't have the community to support them. You know, he's from Chicago, but he has that Kentucky twang, right? And I have pictures of the Brady pictures of Civil War, of these guys sitting on the stoops after the Civil War, staring out into space, thinking, you know, those guys are doing the same thing that World War One, World War Two, Korean, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan veterans are going through. I think Prine is a consummate narrator. I think his narrative captures that sense of despair.
Well, I think I read in your chapter work that you've got the annual symposium or seminar you do for PTSD.
Correct.
That obviously this is a deep meaning subject to you. Yeah, we've been talking about trying to do one here in Juneau this year. I'll probably give you a call to get some ideas.
Yeah.
We spoke to one of the speakers from the convention this summer about her book, Jessica Goodell. I don't know if you've read that, Shaded Black.
No, I haven't, no.
No, she's got a pretty heart-wrenching story and a pretty fascinating recovery as well. Again, because she had community support, like you mentioned, that you guys have had in doing what you're doing. And now I wouldn't say she's speaking out against the wars, but she's speaking out for veterans' needs more than anything. And that's what kind of spurred my interest in starting and getting a symposium up here.
We're very careful with those symposia, not to make them political events. You know, we've had politicians try to come in and speak and do that stuff, and we said no. And the beauty of that, of those symposia, we've done four of them now, four, yeah. Is it brings together veterans, their families, and clinicians in the same space. We've had up to 150, 200 people attend them in multiple workshops afterwards. And they normally don't have the conversations that they have on that particular day. It's a very valuable experience. So I highly recommend it. Be ready, though. It's a tough day. It's a really tough day.
John here, Doug. I bet it's a tough day, and we have a lot to learn. One thing we've talked about is the fact that not everyone in the community trusts us. They assume we have an agenda, which of course we do when we're standing on the street corner or in the foot of the federal building or something. But we understand that we'd have to squelch that and just look at the person in need. That sort of gets to a question I had anticipated asking you about how your chapter and Veterans for Peace in general has managed or not managed to communicate and get along with other veterans organizations. I have anecdotal knowledge of this situation there, here, and that situation there, some harmonious and some not so. Do you have any observations about that and about the fact that we all suspect each other's agendas?
Yeah. Well, it's not all been roses, I'll tell you. We've had an ongoing battle with the American Legion here in Portland, Maine, for years. And there are some people who are going to just look at us one way, and no matter what we do to change their minds, they're just not going to change their minds. And, they're no longer of concern to me, quite frankly. My concern is for the soldiers who are serving now and who have served in the past, and whatever we can do to help them. that's what I care about. And oftentimes, individuals in the American Legion or VFW and groups like that will, you know, we'll sit down and talk with us, and you know, we can share our concerns and stuff like that. And I often say, you know, where I'm, you know, I don't hide the fact that I'm opposed to the wars. But I say I'm equally concerned about the well-being of our soldiers. And we've taken, Veterans for Peace has taken on the attitude that we want to end the wars, bring the soldiers home, and take care of them, and do the best we can and divert the money away from the wars and helping these people heal and get back into the culture. I just recently showed on my campus a movie just came out called Where Do Soldiers Come From? It captures five Afghan veterans in northern Michigan in four years of getting out of high school, going to National Guard, going to Afghanistan, and coming back. And so we do things like that. We'll show movies like that, you know, to open up the discussion. And we don't hide our you know, why we exist, but we also open ourselves up for other conversations, and that helps, I think.
Well, there's got to be some common ground that you share with other veterans. I know one in 2006, I believe, during the debate about torture and some of the evidence that was being revealed at that point in time, the news media was getting things out. VFP here in Juneau tried to prepare for a press release, a joint press release with the other two, VFW and American Legion. And we almost had it pulled off. One of the organizations, at least, was very, very interested in working with us. They both opposed the torture policies of the Bush administration. But I think politics, you know, eventually got in the way, and they did not want to associate with VFP at the last minute, and the whole thing fell apart.
Yeah. We had an incident with the American Legion a few years ago. They had this award thing they set up. They said, you know, if you give us $100, we'll put the name of a victim of the, you know, of Iraq War, a soldier or whatever, on the lamppost down the main street in Portland, Maine. And we said, that's terrific. And we gave our $100 and gave them the name of a six-month-old Iraqi boy who was killed. And they just went bananas and denied us access to the Veterans Day parade. And we fought them, and we won it big time. We fought them in public opinion, and people came around from all different places, and we wrote letters to the editor, and people, you know, everybody was supporting our position and not the American Legions, which was, you know, we're veterans. We belong in that parade. And we have a statement, but you can't deny us that. So that won us a lot of it didn't win us prizes with the American Legion, for sure, but it won us a lot of credibility with other people. And we had a chance, again, to speak about why we're doing what we're doing. And we're always saying, you know, we're in support of these people. It's, you know, that, you know, the usual thing that's been tossed against our group all the time, that we don't support the troops. I'd say that's patently absurd. You know, what other group of people think so much about these people all the time? But it's, you know, it's an ongoing battle. You're right, and the politics always gets in the way, and there's always somebody who's got some kind of personal agenda. And if they've got a loud voice and a place to speak, they sometimes win the day. But we just keep on doing what we do, though.
Hey, Doug, John again here. I had a question about another veterans organization, Iraq Veterans Against the War.
Yeah.
I think Veterans for Peace members are proud of having mentored that group, and it's great to see them coming along. And, you know, we don't, I think, right now have any active members from the Iraq War. There's some on paper, but and I can sort of understand why. There's a feeling that their army is different from our army and all that. And, you know, sometimes you can obsess over the differences rather than the similarities and the things we share. But one thing I was encouraged to hear about recently was that Iraq Veterans Against the War has some sort of a committee. I think it's called Afghanistan Veterans Against the War. It sounds like some sort of preparatory effort to forming yet another organization, or perhaps expanding the one. Do you know anything about that?
I don't know anything about that, but you know, I think you're absolutely right. The IVAW guys, men and women, you know, which is really something wonderful. Are the Young Turks, right? We're the old guys. It's unfortunate we have to look at ourselves that way. I mean, that's okay with me. I'm not going to get any younger, but and I see their agenda, and I see, you know, and I wish them, you know, Godspeed and all that stuff. But it's going to take years. It did for us, right? I mean, it's going to, you know, I don't think we'll have much of a commitment from that particular war for another 10 years, maybe, or 15 years. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
But we just have to be here for them.
Well, another organization VFP was quite a mentor to was Military Family Speaks Out, which I belong to. My son served one tour in Afghanistan and three in Iraq.
Oh, my God.
And I helped get a chapter off the ground in Alaska for Military Family Speaks Out in 2006, right after Donald Rumsfeld redeployed the unit he was in that was out of Fairbanks to Baghdad at the last minute. I mean, some of these kids had actually arrived back in Fairbanks and were put on a plane and sent back to Baghdad. There was a lot of families that were pretty upset with that. We were able to capture some of that energy. But nationally, Military Family Speaks Out has been much closer to VFP. And, in fact, Michael McPherson, former executive director and now a board member, spoke about mentoring both of those organizations and the need to keep both of those organizations close to them, to continue to support them, because it is the same statement. I mean, Military Family Speaks Out was bring them home now and support them when they get here. That was their motto.
Yep.
Yeah, so there are a lot of similarities. It doesn't need to be just veterans. I mean, families never used to speak. They used to be pretty silent as well.
Yeah, I'm really proud of the fact that when we formed Veterans for Peace, we developed an associate membership category for people who supported our organization who weren't veterans, and oftentimes people who join us as associate members are family members, people who are fathers and mothers and or sons and daughters of people in the military, and I think that made us unique back in 85. It probably still does. That's a full membership of folks like that. So Military Family Speak Out is an amazing group of people. I have friends who are in that as well, so I agree.
Doug, a while back in this conversation, you were talking about the Veterans for Peace in the statement of principles that we work for the abolition of war. And I thought it would be important for the public to know that that's a qualified thing, that we certainly would work toward that, but I forget the words, but somehow our nation's right to defend itself is preserved in that statement. I can't think of the wording, but we don't believe in leaving ourselves defenseless.
No, we don't believe in unilateral disarmament. Some people, well, we've had this argument for years, of course, are we a pacifist organization or not, right? And we have pacifists who are in our organization, but we're not a pacifist organization as far as I can see it. Nonviolent direct activists is a much better phrase, I think. I don't think there are very few members, I would imagine, in DFP who think that we shouldn't have a military. I think most people think we should have a strong defensive military, not one that's going off and serving the empire, if you will, or as Tobias Wolff called it, Pharaoh's Army. Wonderful book about Vietnam, so, in Pharaoh's Army.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not pacifists. We're not a pacifist organization. We're not a service organization either. We wouldn't have 501c3 status if we our primary intent was to serve the well-being of soldiers. We're an organization to oppose war, and part of that process is serving veterans, but that's not our primary purpose.
Yeah, I think that's one reason why it's important that we can continue to encourage the organizations that do have a service mission, at least in that limited capacity.
Yeah, and we have members in our organization at NSA, right? You know, that who are career military,
right.
Spent 20 years in the military, right? And so they're not walking away from that, saying I hate the military, but they're walking away from it, looking at what the military has been doing, and saying, no, this is wrong. We've got to work.
But you've also been looking at what war is. I think both of you, again, having served in war, and you've mentioned that, you know, the sense of responsibility you have to let people know that war really is a horror. And the abolition of war, and I think, that, you know, I tried to capture that just before we went off the air. I know that what you're talking about, John, I think it says something to the effect of to eliminate war as an instrument of national policy or national foreign
right.
policy.
Yes.
And that is, it's speaking about leaving war as a last resort defensive or purpose. Department of Defense, I mean, it was the Department of War until after World
right.
War II. The Department of Defense should be protecting the homeland, and maybe if it was just here in the homeland, we wouldn't need Homeland Security.
Right. Absolutely. If the National Guard wasn't federalized, if they were, you know, truly state organizations, which they were intended to be, we wouldn't have all those soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq doing multiple tours. I just did a speaking thing in a local high school, and I did it alongside an Afghan vet. We had a lot in common, and a lot, you know, and some differences, but we shared that sort of abhorrence with the war. And his unit had gone over to Afghanistan and Iraq, I don't know how many times.
So. Yeah, I don't know if it's plain from our statement of principles, Rich, you've tried to get us to talk about our knowledge and experience of war, but in a way it's almost unknowable to get your head around something that makes so little sense. But then over time, if you have the opportunity and the inclination to look inside and look deeper at issues, you realize that at least on a personal level, we're opposed to militarization or militarism.
Yeah. Yes.
Not the military, not military people. You know, we met some great people in the military and still know a bunch of great people in the military, but militarism is a sickness that our nation shouldn't have.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different animal, you know. And we don't have time to explore that tonight. But
yeah. A symbol of that, we get all kinds of flack for standing in opposition to the Blue Angels when they show up, and people just can't fathom that because they find, you know, that to be as American as apple pie. And, you know, we point out that exactly as you're saying, this is just another symbol of the militarization of this culture. You know, so we're not necessarily, you know, celebrating the technical expertise, of which there is great amount in these pilots. You know, essentially America's celebrating war. Those planes are not made as transport planes.
Yeah, it's the machinery, and I think I just read the other day that the United States is opposing the ban on cluster bombs.
Sure, yeah.
You know, that's a uglier version of them. They're not going to fly those over the skies in a parade like thing, but it, you know, that's militarism. I mean, that's creating a lot of weapons that are indiscriminately murderous.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, the other phenomenon that I speak to young people about, you know, and you have to be careful because, again, I live in rural Maine, and virtually all the students and young people I run into have got loved ones who serve in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I say, this culture is doing them a huge disservice by referring to every soldier as a hero. I think it's by design, because it puts a distance between the soldier and his or her family and his or her community. If you're a hero, you can't sit down and talk to somebody about the horrific things that you've seen and done and participated in. You've got to maintain this stance as hero. And if that doesn't lead to PTSD, I don't know what else would.
Well, and that's why a lot of veterans from World War II never told their stories as well. They came home all at once, heroes from the war of all wars, and could not talk about what they'd seen because it was a time for celebration.
Yeah, people didn't want to hear it. They did not want to hear it. Right? And in Vietnam, I mean, we put it in their faces, right? And they still didn't want to hear it. Of course, ours was a television war, and now the kids have got this internet war. Again, if you get a chance to see this movie, Where Soldiers Come From, I highly recommend it, because it shows these kids, and, you know, they're going out looking for IEDs, and then they get back in their little hooches, and they Skype their parent, It's right there on the screen. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. How are you? It's very strange.
Yeah, I think the internet war, the drone war, it makes the burden on VFP and any peace organization grow, unfortunately.
Yeah.
You know, we've got more things to be aware of, more things to oppose, more work to do.
Right.
It never seems to end, but it also means you need committed people like you guys that have been doing it and continue to do it and know what the value of it is and know why you're doing it.
To our graves, probably, right? So, but yeah, it's and there we make many missteps, right? I mean, I remember in the early 90s when the first Persian Gulf War started off, I was up on my soapbox about the draft and how horrible it's going to be, and they've got to do it and all this stuff, and they turn around, of course, and privatize the military and change the whole thing, and now they're robotizing it with the drones and stuff, so who knows?
Well, and it's sad right now. I think in Afghanistan, of course, the economy's taken precedent over the news.
Right.
The Afghanistan war is almost out of the news, but we're losing
mm-hmm.
a fair amount of soldiers every
yeah.
month.
Yeah, sure.
We were paying attention to that body count in Iraq when that was happening. The news media is not even noticing what's going on in Afghanistan.
I know. It's a travesty.
Yeah.
Yeah, it truly is. I mean, it's, when you... You look at the eyes of these kids, as family members are in these wars, and they realize that nobody's paying attention to that. I mean, this is what this Afghan veteran, when he's talking to the students, he came back from the war, and people looked at him and said, "What war? Where were you? What's going on?" This guy said, "Jesus, they're not even aware of the fact that stuff is going on."
Well, we're getting close to the end of the night, Doug. I really appreciate you being here. If you got any last words of wisdom for a little chapter in the remote part of the world up here in Juneau.
You realize this is midnight in Maine, my words of wisdom disappeared many, many hours ago. I just got to say that, first of all, let me say welcome home to you and welcome home to your son, and all the other members. I love you guys. I love the work that you're doing. And when we started Veterans for Peace, we had no idea that it would last as long as it's lasted and, be extensive as it is. So no words of wisdom other than just keep up the good fight.
Well, thank you, Doug, and thanks for your work on the board to come.
Yeah, you're welcome. So my last word is it sounds like.
Yeah.
What else can I say, right?
Well, I certainly appreciate you staying up late. We could have recorded this earlier, but it's always more enjoyable to do it live. But I know it's a burden from midnight back there, I guess. It's still early here.
It's a labor of love, and I really appreciate you asking me to be on.
Thank you for being here. And I guess we'll say good night. I want to thank John also for joining me tonight. I never like doing the show alone, and I think John and Doug have two really important things in common and keep getting an organization going and bringing their war experience to the table to give it credibility, and I really appreciate you doing that, John.
Thank you, Rich.
And I want to thank John Kremers for running the controls tonight, and I remind you, you've been listening to Peace Talk on KTOO. And have a wonderful evening and a wonderful Thanksgiving.